You're listening to KTOO's Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and on the phone with me, my next guest is Walter Echo Hawk. Welcome, Walter.
Thank you for having me, Shelley.
Oh, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's a real honor to meet and speak with you. Would you please introduce yourself for our listeners who may not know who you are?
Yes, I'd be delighted to. My name is Walter Echo Hawk, and I am a Pawnee Indian from the state of Oklahoma. And I've been an attorney since 1973, involved in protecting the rights of Indian tribes across the country. I had worked for the Native American Rights Fund as a staff attorney from 1973 to 2009. And representing Indian tribes in a wide variety of legal issues across the country during the modern era of federal Indian law as a part of the tribal sovereignty movement that has led to the rise of our modern Indian nations.
One of the quotes, this is kind of a paraphrase quote from you from your video bio, is that you wanted to address the dark side of federal Indian law and reform it so that it would be a shield and not a sword to be used against the people. Could you say more about that?
Yes. I was very troubled during my years as a staff attorney with the Native American Rights Fund in the 90s and through the turn of the century by the Supreme Court trend towards trimming back on hard-fought Native rights. And I just couldn't understand why we were losing so many cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. So, and it was very troubling and of concern to me, and as well as my colleagues in federal Indian law. So I undertook to study the dark side of federal Indian law in a 3 or 4 year legal analysis, and came out with a book in the year 2010 entitled The Courts of the Conqueror, The 10 Worst Indian Law Cases Ever Decided. And that book was a critical legal analysis of the dark side of federal Indian law, where I took 10 of the very worst Supreme Court decisions decided against Indians and analyzed those opinions. I read the written words of the justices in those cases, looked at the holdings in those cases, and analyzed the times in which those decisions were written to try to learn, you know, why are there so many miscarriages of justice that are found in the Supreme Court decisions pertaining to Indians over the years. And one of the cases that was included in that study was the Tihatun Band of Tlingit Indians versus the United States, which was decided by the Supreme Court in 1955, affecting the U.S. Forest Service's roughshod management of the Tlingit homeland here, located in the Tungus National Forest. And that case was, according to my legal analysis, you know, one of the 10 worst cases ever decided, and had all of the elements that I found to be common threads in cases that constitute this dark side of the law affecting our Native people here in the United States.
Did you come to any conclusions, maybe personal opinions about why these rulings happened?
Yes, a number of them. A lot of it goes to the legal framework of federal Indian law, which as it was created by John Marshall, the Supreme Court Justice, imported the law of colonialism in the 1820s to define Native American rights here in the United States, you know, of Indian tribes. And that law of colonialism, as he imported it in whole cloth into our domestic legal system, it does contain some protective features. It talks about the treaties with the tribes and their inherent rights of self-government, their inherent right of sovereignty, and the protectorate relationship that was established between the United States and Indian nations. These are all very, very protective features under which great nation-building strides were made by those Indian nations under those features in the modern era of federal Indian law. But it also contains a dark side, this law of colonialism, notions of plenary power over Native people, notions of conquest, notions of discovery used to define Native land rights, notions of race and racism, racial and cultural and religious inferiority, and also the use of, instead of facts to decide cases, instead employing legal fictions or presumptions used by the courts to reach an unjust result in these cases. All many features, including apologies, you know, a lot of them begin these opinions, all written by the finest legal minds of the day, begin with these big apologies. You know, we can't look at notions of justice or debate morality when defining Indian rights, which is kind of like judicial code. When you read that in opinion, you know something very unjust is about to happen. But this Teotihuacan opinion that was written by Justice Reed for the court in 1955 had all of these features. It was based upon the law of colonialism, the doctrines of discovery, doctrines of conquest. It said that the Teotihuacans were savages, that every American schoolboy knows that all Indian tribes were conquered, and after the coming of the white man, Indians retained their aboriginal rights and were able to occupy the land only with permission of the whites, and held that in a conquered land, Congress can confiscate Indian land without having to compensate the Indians, you know. And these, of course, all were incorrect. You know, Indians are not inferior. The Tlinkets were never conquered by anyone, and so on and so forth, you know. And so, the court was able to fashion a rule of confiscation of property, despite the protections in the Fifth Amendment, you know, because property ownership here in our country under the Fifth Amendment is a sacred cow to all of our landowners. You know, you can't confiscate property without due process of law and paying just compensation. But the Supreme Court in that case said that the Forest Service could basically trash the Tungus National Park Forest with a massive timber sale through their habitat and their villages without paying them a dime. And, of course, that is a manifestly unjust decision that is still the law today, and it's never been reversed. You know, thankfully, Congress stepped in to compensate them in later legislation and setting aside protecting their traditional subsistence right in their homeland here in Southeast Alaska. But that's going to be the focus of my lecture tomorrow at the Sea Alaska Institute, Walter Soboloff Building, tomorrow afternoon, or I guess it's over the noon hour, and I hope all your listeners be interested in coming over.
Well, that's right, and I don't know if you've been following our local news, but the Tongass has been in the news a lot this week, especially in the last couple of weeks, in regards to the roadless rule. So I'm sure that there will be some discussion around that tomorrow at your talk, and the talk is at noon. Thursday, November 7th, that's tomorrow, in the Walter Soboloff Building, free and open to the public as part of the Native American Heritage Lecture Series, Native American Heritage Month Lecture Series happening there. So that's one of the things that brought you to Juneau this week. And the other thing that you'll be doing is a book lecture on another book, not the one that you mentioned, but a different one called The Sea of Grass. That's actually Friday at 7 o'clock in the Egan Library. Tell me about that book.
That book is my first venture into writing a historical novel, and The Sea of Grass is a kind of a Native American version of Roots, in which I trace 10 generations of the Echohawk family, my own family, in the Sea of Grass there in the central plains of the United States. And that book came out about a year ago, and I've been on a book lecture tour ever since. The book hopes to inspire readers to research their own families and tell the powerful stories of their ancestors, because all of us, no matter who we are and what race we come from, what our culture is, we all share one great truth, and that is we all owe a great debt of gratitude to our ancestors because they survived the travails of their time, and we're here as a result of that. We owe our very lives as well as our cultures and our history to our ancestors. And so, like Alex Haley, who traced 7 generations of his family back to Africa, the Sea of Grass traces 10 families, 10 generations of my family in the central plains of the Pawnee homeland there in Nebraska and Kansas area. So I hope that this book will be a great tool, a teaching resource tool for Native American studies, you know, for students that are interested in contemporary Native American literature, Native culture, Native history, you know, because any student, regardless of who they are or where they come from, also has family roots that extend far back into time, and this book hopes to inspire them to research those roots.
Well, it sounds lovely, not to judge a book by its title, but The Sea of Grass is a beautiful title. It really evokes that simple words that evoke a lovely image of the plains. Walter Echohawk, thank you so much for speaking with me today. You can catch his lecture tomorrow at noon at the Walter Soboloff Building on the Tihitan versus the United States case study in Indigenous justice, and then the author talk Friday, November 8th, 7 p.m., Egan Library, hear about his book, The Sea of Grass. Another quote in your video bio said that the work of one attorney can make the world a better place, even though you said there's a lot of people working on a lot of the issues that you're working on, and you've had a lot of help along the way. I think that that's a great quote, and it really exemplifies you and your work and your legacy.
Well, thank you, Shelley. That's very kind of you, and thanks for having me. I'm just very, very much in awe to be in this beautiful southeast Alaska here. It's just such an awesome place to be.
It's quite different from the rest of the country. So we're glad you're here, and welcome, and enjoy your visit, and safe travels.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you as well. Goodbye.
Bye.